Afternoon, everyone. We are just about to get started. My name is Russell Hsiao. I am the Executive Director of GTI. GTI is a think tank dedicated to Taiwan policy research, and we have a number of programs that we are launching today, with this one being our public seminar series that we'll be hosting every 2 weeks. So please stay tuned. If you haven't already subscribed to our newsletter updates, I hope that you will on our website at www.globaltaiwan.org. We also have a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief, which provides timely analysis about Taiwan policy issues. We just released our second issue today, so when you subscribe, you will receive that also as well.
You have just heard the Global Taiwan Institute's Executive Director, Russell Hsiao, welcoming our audience to our first public seminar, The Taiwan Policy Review at 22, held on September 28th at GTI. This event featured Walter Lohmann, Richard Bush, and David Keegan discussing the Taiwan Policy Review. Unfortunately, we had slight sound issues during the event, and the first question was cut off along with the beginning of Richard Bush's first answer. We apologize and are rereading the question for your reference here, and then we'll cut back to the original recording. Thank you. The first question was directed to Richard Bush and went as follows. You were at the House Foreign Affairs Committee in 1994 and very involved in the Taiwan Policy Review. Can you shed some light for us on the policy and political considerations leading up to the TPR?
Party in the House and the Senate felt a certain amount of restraint that when it came to Taiwan, not everybody, but some, they didn't want to do things to embarrass their president, their Republican president. But when it was a Democratic president, those restraints no longer existed. The TPR was only one of a number of policy issues, initiatives that affected Taiwan and U.S. policy. One was something to liberalize the handling of arms sales. That started in 93 and played out in the spring of 1994. Another was the rules concerning transits by Taiwan leaders. Li Denghui had a bad experience in April of 1994 in Hawaii, and he was bound and determined to change the rules of the game. Also playing out at that time was the issue of the linkage of China's MFN status with human rights. That had no direct impact. But the MFN saga affected the overall environment in which the TPR took place. And I suspect it affected the timing of the TPR. This was actually a period of a great change, a new environment, people asking some fundamental questions about how we related to Taiwan and how that might change relative to what we had done before.
Thank you very much, Richard. David, let me move to you quickly. It's you were at the Taiwan Coordination Desk at the time of the TPR. Can you describe the operational considerations at the time when the TPR was conducted? What were the objectives, and how did they track with the results?
Okay. Thank you, everybody. And thank you to Richard for setting the context so clearly. I arrived on the Taiwan desk in, I think, September of 1992. And when I arrived, I was told something that didn't make a lot of sense to a Foreign Service officer. Foreign Service officers, when you arrive in a new job, you're told, go out and do something, okay? Accomplish something, put your name on it. And when I got in the Taiwan staff, I was told, no, that's not what we're here for. We're here to make sure things don't happen. and relax, it's gonna be a quiet 2 years. So the first week I was on the Taiwan staff or the Taiwan desk, lo and behold, Taiwan decides it wants to join the GATT, which will soon become the World Trade Organization. I had been assured that would not happen, but lo and behold, on my first week, here we have this major new initiative from Taiwan that we have to deal with. We're in the middle of a presidential election campaign. George H.W. Bush Sr., is looking for votes in Texas and gets up in Fort Worth and announces to a crowd of Lockheed Martin employees that he's going to sell F-16s to Taiwan, which is a major change from our policy up till then. Remember that the 1982 arms sales communique that we signed with the PRC to limit arms sales to Taiwan was first and foremost a communique to prevent us from selling combat aircraft to Taiwan. So here's Richard Bush. I'm sorry, Richard Bush. Uncle George, that will keep it clear, who has reversed the policy that he is most clearly associated with. So all of a sudden, I realized this is going to be a much busier time than I had expected. And as Richard notes, the context has changed. Okay, we have Bill Clinton, who's also running, who has famously denounced the butchers of Beijing. Okay, we have the democratic transition from Jiang Jinguo to Li Donghui, which really, as Richard said, sort of makes them a poster child for a peaceful democratic transition. In addition, two things are going on in Taiwan's immediate environment. First of all, the Taiwan economic miracle requires that they diversify their international economic linkages, and the World Trade Organization GATT membership fits exactly into that. It also helps them diversify away from an over-reliance on Beijing. The second thing is, since the Shanghai communique, we have not sold combat aircraft to Taiwan. Okay, and the combat aircraft they do have are beginning to become not only obsolete but dangerous to fly. They need a beefing up of their defensive capability, and so all of that comes to a head. And it comes to a head during an election campaign, which means there is no political leadership. Okay, the Republican administration, we're going to discover in a month or two, is on its way out. The Democratic administration has not yet taken hold. And all of a sudden, all of these bureaucrats around the United States government who have been lectured by the State Department, don't do anything with Taiwan. Okay? Stay away from Taiwan. Our job is not to do anything, not to offend the probably at that point 1.1 billion Chinese people by doing anything with Taiwan. All of a sudden, here you have both on the defense side and on the economic trade side two major initiatives, and all the bureaucrats around the U.S. government are saying, oh boy, here's something to do. And suddenly we're getting phone calls saying, how can we work with you on Taiwan? And offices around the State Department are doing the same. And so from deadly quiet, we're going to something approaching chaos. And so really, at a certain level, the Taiwan Relations Act was a response to that. In the early days of policy review, thank you. Thank you, George. And it's a response that really takes hold in the first days of the Clinton administration, because the new administration has decided it's going to establish a series of policy reviews about issues that they're going to be confronting in the foreign affairs arena. And Lib Pascoe, who is our Deputy Assistant Secretary in EAP, Joe Borich, who is the office director, and I said, well, you haven't suggested a policy review on Taiwan, but maybe it would be a good idea. So we worked to get a Taiwan policy review started. And our idea was, with all of this bureaucratic attention we were getting, we wanted something that would direct how we would work with and work on Taiwan as a U.S. government. And it would give us the ability to direct that activity in strategic directions. And so that's essentially how the Taiwan Policy Review got started. It was really a bureaucratic response.
Well, I'd like to continue that line of actually questioning on what you just, where you left off, and that is, so I believe that you were actually involved in a number of reviews on Taiwan policy, and I was wondering, can you describe what the considerations were in those reviews as well?
We have looked at various aspects of our Taiwan activities. We've never done, to my knowledge, a policy review that has been as extensive as the one we did in 92-94. And I think there's a good reason for that. And I think the reason essentially is that when we're working on a Taiwan issue and there is a specific issue at hand, whether it's Taiwan's self-defense, Taiwan's trade access to the rest of the world, its WTO accession, we get a very focused and I think a very useful cooperation within the U.S. government and with Taiwan. When we do something that is abstract, like a Taiwan policy review, it often becomes a very diffuse activity. And I would actually argue that that was the problem with the Taiwan policy review, is it did not have that kind of very tightly focused objectives. And quite frankly, it didn't have that close direction from the White House and the NSC that would have enabled us to impose that direction.
Walter, just another hard question. It's a lot has changed since 1982 and to the Taiwan Policy Review, and arguably a lot has changed as well between 1994 and 2016. Can you walk us through the changes that may or may not necessitate another review, capital or otherwise?
Thank you. Well, thank you for having me here, Chris. I appreciate it. Russell first asked me and told me the company I'd be keeping, I said, I don't think so, because actually Richard's book is sitting on my desk right now, so whenever I need to know something about Taiwan, I give him a call on the policy and specifics. Directly to the question, the whole world has changed since 1994. Things have changed so much between 1982 and 1994, as Richard lays out, end of the Cold War, among other things. Not quite that epic-making changes, but very big things have changed around the relationship with Taiwan. So, first of all, the economic relationship that we have with China. I think you can't ignore that. We went from a time in 1994 where we had basically equal trading relationship with both sides of the straits. China is now 10 times or more times bigger than that. We have now a full-scale relationship with the Chinese, with dozens and dozens of dialogues every year. The SNED, the JCCT, all the defense-related dialogues. It's such an intense relationship and engagement across the bureaucracies. We have big things on our plate with them. This administration puts a lot of emphasis on climate change and the Paris protocols. That's one thing that they had at the top of their list in the last year dealing with the Chinese. Taiwan has changed in very big ways since 1994. Obviously, the advent of democracy there, the continuing trend lines on Taiwan identity that show Taiwanese even more today, think of themselves as more Taiwanese than as the other Chinese side of the strait as they may have done in 1972. So that's changed. The challenge from the Chinese side, from the Chinese side of the strait, has changed. It wasn't the threat then that it may be today. The modernization of its military, et cetera. So all kinds of things have changed about the relationship that I think are context around any policy review that we would conduct. And I think all of those factors would come into play in the course of the review, like it or not. It shouldn't be, okay? We should be looking at Taiwan just as our relationship with Taiwan, the strategic importance of it, how we can preserve that importance, et cetera. But let's face it, when it comes down to the review itself, there's going to be all kinds of constituencies that get involved in it. And all of those big factors with the Chinese today will be at least as big as they were in 1994, if not bigger.
That's great. That's a great lead into... Excuse me.
You're good.
Rafina, is this all right? Is this working?
Although I think did you turn it off?
No.
Okay.
Let me just try this one here. Testing? Okay, good. All right. It's good that we have a spare up here just in case. For anyone who attended our opening ceremony, then we realized that we had a malfunction with our microphones. But this leads into a great question for Richard, actually, and that is Ambassador Winston Lord described in his Senate Foreign Relations Committee statement that the TPR, quote, enhance, unquote, close quote, relations with Taiwan. However, reactions about its successes and accomplishments or shortcomings have been rather covered over a pretty wide spectrum, or pretty mixed. What accounts for the discrepancy in these viewpoints?
Let me say, first of all, that much of what is actually in the Taiwan Policy Review has to do with what you might refer to as the rules of engagement between U.S. officials and their Taiwan counterparts. And the results of that are not sort of seen by the public, but they happen. The area of greatest disappointment to me from the Taiwan Policy Review itself was the economic side, where we thought that there was going to be major progress. There was a TIFA signed at the same time. But, you know, it's been stop and go since then. You know, Taiwan's accession to the WTO was a major sort of move forward, but we have been restrained in other ways. Part of the problem is Taiwan's reluctance to reform. Part of it is USTR's approach to negotiations. The underlying factor that governs the current, the day-to-day conduct of U.S.-Taiwan relations and the tenor of U.S.-Taiwan relations is, you know, whether there's an overlap of interests between the two governments. And we had our difficulties in the late 90s and through part of the 2000s. It got better after 2008. And so that's, you know, that I think is what you have to look at to assess, you know, how's our relationship going?
Walter, going back to you then, what are the dangers, if any, if the U.S. does not conduct a Taiwan policy review?
Well, you know, I've always thought that there was actually more danger in doing one than not doing one, because you open up a Pandora's box really of interests and constituencies, just like I referenced a second ago, that would all come into play in the review, and I'm sure that came into play during the review in 1994. But I think it could be done as a package of other things that a new administration would bring into office with them. For instance, you could have a review just focused on the guidelines for U.S. Taiwan contact, diplomatic guidelines. So you could look sort of across the board at all the things like your flag issues, and what kind of letterhead you're allowed to use, and can you drink coffee or tea? And, I mean, they're all kind of minutiae of the diplomatic relationship, but I think cumulatively they're very important, because they send a signal about how we treat Taiwan, how we see it in an international context. Of course, there would be pushback on that, not least of which from the State Department lawyers who formulated and have enforced them since. But I think just the very fact that those things do change occasionally, like flying the flag in Taipei, AIT, just the fact that they change occasionally means they're not really carved in stone, and they don't necessarily, all of them, represent some sort of official contact with Taiwan, that you could reformulate those to update them, really. And then save some of the other big pieces for sort of separate action. So you have a review just focused on the diplomatic contact issues, and then a new administration could come in with other high-profile things, an arms sale, you know, something on international space, TPP, those bigger things and bigger strategic questions I would not include in a review. But I think if it was managed that way, it could be done successfully and minimize the danger of ending up in a worse place than you started. I mean, when you consider doing it, you also have to keep in mind that you're going to be living with the results for the next 20 years. So you have to be very careful, I think, what you put on the table.
Yeah, let me throw in a bureaucrat's perspective on that, if I may. I think the challenge in any consideration of a policy review is going to be how you manage the inevitable focus on these issues. I agree with you that you divide up the sort of rules of the road from some of the specific issues, such as defense, such as international economics, which I would argue really are going to drive the relationship more than anything else. But the rules of the road have actually worked best when the least attention has been paid to them, because it actually gives you, within the U.S. government and within the Taiwan government, the most flexibility to find the adjustments that are possible at the time. And so, for example, in the early 2000s, we hit a situation where we had been required, ever since the passage of the Taiwan Relations Act, to have people resign from the U.S. government to go work at AIT. And so you'd go to somebody who's 30 years old and you'd say, "Hi, I'd like you to resign from the U.S. government." And they're going, "Wait a minute, I have a pension, I have a promotion coming up, this is a bad thing." And we'd say, no, it's going to work just fine, trust us. And then it didn't. And so we had some very messy situations, and that gave us the opportunity very quietly to change the way in which we did business in Taiwan so that we were able to bring people to Taiwan without having them resign from the U.S. government, which gave us access to much higher quality people who wanted to work in Taiwan, and was a major step forward both for our civilian bureaucracies and our military bureaucracies. We did it by doing it quietly. We changed the way we handle the flag. We changed the way we do July 4th receptions. If we had tried to lay that out across the U.S. government, we'd still be arguing over the commas.
Just reinforce that. I mean, I agree that the time has probably come to go through all of these things, but I also agree with David that the quieter, the better. Some of the most significant changes in the way we interact with Taiwan have occurred just because it was decided by a few people that it would be a good thing to do. Let me give you two examples that were secret at the time but are no longer. Number one, early 1996, a decision is made that we need a better channel with the top of the Taiwan government. And so a channel was created. And Sandy Berger, who was then Deputy National Security Advisor, met with his Taiwan counterpart in the United States, and that has been a good channel. Second, fall of 1997, a decision was made that we needed a better way to talk with our counterparts in Taiwan's defense establishment. And so this became known as the Monterey talks. They're still going on, but these didn't need a policy review to make them happen. They weren't authorized in the Taiwan Policy Review of 1994, but we did them because they were necessary.
And Walter, I would just add, those two happened in the 90s, and throughout the 2000s, we found ourselves in the same situation where we would say, you know, to move this forward, whether it's a WTO issue or a military issue, we need to be able to talk to these people. And so we would find a very quiet way to talk to these people, and very often the decision chain, and I apologize to all of those theorists of bureaucracy, was that somebody in Taiwan and somebody on the Taiwan desk and somebody in AIT in Roslyn, one of us would have an idea. We'd go to the other two, say, "What do you think? Will this help?" And they'd say, "Yeah, that's a good idea." And so you'd very quietly go up the chain, say, "It's a good idea, say yes." And we would get it done. Now, this is not an ideal situation. You'd love to have it be more public so you could take more credit for it and so that it would have more of a public impact. But done very quietly, it advanced the substantive issues both on the Taiwan side and the U.S. side.
Just very quickly, maybe it's from my own congressional perspective that I think of it this way, but I think the problem with this scenario is that there's no accountability involved in it. And so what I mean is we know, say from the outside, Heritage or at in Congress, we know Friends of Taiwan are working hard for Taiwan within the administration, within the State Department. But we don't always know all the good things that are happening, right? So, and we also know that sometimes the bad guys win too, right? And so that's the problem with trying to keep it too quiet, is that you don't get a full buy-in, you don't get all your friends on the outside to support it and then be able to support long-term decisions that are made.
And I think that's right. And I think the missing piece that we haven't talked about, but I think is part of reality, but you know from your background, is when things like this happen and we're not going to make a big deal of it, someone picks up the phone and calls a staffer on the Hill. Staffers on the Hill are really the glue that holds a lot of this together. And we say, look, here's what we're thinking about. Does this work for you? Does this work for your committee? Does this work for your members? Do you have other ideas? And sometimes if we're not moving in the appropriate direction, believe it or not, somebody on the Hill will call us up and say, why aren't you doing more about X, Y, and Z? And we'd have those conversations. And occasionally, either one of us, either the Hill side or the State Department side, will say, you know, this is a good topic for a hearing. Why don't we have a hearing on this, get a few ideas floating around, and acknowledge what's happening? So I think it's important that those channels be open. But I think particularly given the dynamics of the Taiwan relationship, it's often better if they're done that way.
This is a fascinating discussion, and I think you all agree that if I had let them loose, they would talk on forever. But I do have a few more questions I wanted to ask before we open up the floor for Q&A from the audience. And that is, and this is a good segue also from just the discussion about the conduct of the Taiwan Policy Review, and that is, given the complexity of the growing relationship between U.S., Taiwan, and also China, are the current rules of interaction too restrictive for managing the U.S.-Taiwan relationship? Why or why not? And I'll allow anyone to take this. This is for the entire panel.
See if it's working. Yeah, I'll leave it on. I think there are necessarily requirements that our relationship with Taiwan remain unofficial, and therefore they remain less visible. But I think the restrictions, quite frankly, we have a lot of flexibility. The Taiwan Relations Act is not that long. The Taiwan Policy Review is not that long. When we hit these restrictions and they get in the way of getting something done, there are lots of ways to get around it. And I'll just give you a little example that occurs to me. When I started working on Taiwan, the idea that a Taiwan candidate for president would come and talk to officials in Washington would have given me an Excedrin headache. And yet it's a fairly routine thing now, and I think it's a reminder of the ways in which we can talk about ideas and the ways in which we can share concerns.
Let me just follow on your example. You remember Chun Choi Ben came in 1998. That happened sort of the way you described. I was on my first trip to Taiwan. Daryl Johnson and I were walking into my meeting with Chun, who was then mayor, and I turned to Daryl and said, what do you think about my inviting him to come to Washington, D.C.? Daryl said, good idea. And so we went in, and during the private conversation, I posed that. There was a bit of grumbling back in Washington when they heard about it, but it was a way to put Chun across the table from people he needed to talk to in the U.S. government.
And to put him across the table before we got stuck with some of our formal restrictions, because that would have been difficult to impossible to do once he was inaugurated as president. But because he was the mayor of Taipei, sure, why not? We saw the same thing most recently with the two candidates in the most recent Taiwan presidential election. Both of them came to Washington, both of them had good series of meetings and conversations, and I think that really has advanced our ability to work together over the next several years.
I just wanted to focus briefly on the military relationship and say that I think the restrictions do impose basically constraints on the way that we're able to strategize with
Taiwanese. So, we're always talking about the types of things that the Taiwanese need in their arsenal and the kind of things we can sell them. The submarine issue has been on the table for at least 20 years, substantively. But a lot of that discussion has to be shaped around what the U.S.-Taiwan strategy is for dealing with threat from China. So right now, basically, our strategy is for the Taiwanese to fend off the Chinese long enough to get there, and then we say, okay, get out of the way, let us take care of this. That's basically it. If you're going to get past that into a situation, you know, sort of a situation between the two sides, more integrated, a way that we can really fight together if it comes to that, where we would have options of selling or finding ways to get them submarines more appropriate to a role that they would have with us, where they're not duplicating things, or they get the right fighter jets and that sort of thing that complement U.S. forces. If you're ever going to get to that kind of point, you're going to have real discussions with them. And to that end, the Senate NDAA this year has language in there to direct the DOD to put together a program where we could have exchange of flag and general officers. That's the sort of thing that would get to an assistant secretary level people in state and DOD to be able to exchange, to have these kind of conversations. Now, maybe we could do it in a way that's more quiet than not, or at least it just doesn't shout it from the rooftops. But I think we have to have those kind of conversations if we're going to have a rational plan for defending against the threats to Taiwan in a changing environment.
I would actually go a step. I agree completely with the thrust of what you're saying, and I would actually go a step beyond that, which is, I think too often, for too long, we've looked at Taiwan as a military issue in isolation. It's the United States, it's Taiwan, it's China. We have to realize that we have a very uncertain military strategic environment all along that maritime periphery of East Asia. And so we have to work with Taiwan, and I think we can do it very quietly, but we have to work with Taiwan and with the other players involved very quietly, so that all of us are thinking from the same set of understandings. And so that what Taiwan is doing, the capabilities Taiwan has or choose to acquire, can be fit into the capabilities that we judge are necessary all along that periphery. We can do that very quietly, and my nickel says we are doing it very quietly. And there are lots of ways to conduct those talks. And the challenge is to conduct them both bilaterally and very quietly. I'm not going to use the word multilaterally, but if someone can come up with a synonym, I would appreciate it.
And quickly, just one last question before I open to Q&A from the audience, and that is, on a related note, not specific to the Taiwan Policy Review, is the United States meeting its commitment under the Taiwan Relations Act? If not, how can it better meet its commitment under the TRA? And try to be brief on this one, but nevertheless address it fully as much as possible.
Dave made some remarks along these lines. I would say that the TRA is a very plastic document that doesn't constrain you from, doesn't constrain us from doing what's in our interest. It doesn't block us from doing what's in our interest.
Let me just throw out three words or three ideas. And the first is, I think our relationship needs to always have respect, and respect in both directions, for the concerns of both sides and for the talents that both sides bring. The second thing I think we need to have in our relationship is candor and confidentiality. And I think we've done a very good job of that, but that enables us to get a lot of things done. And the third is, as I suggested a moment ago, our relations with Taiwan have to be fit into our broader strategic calculus.
I read Richard's book, so I know that what he says is true about the TRA. But I certainly agree with that there's, you know, it's hard to say whether it's being met or not. I mean, it's really in the eye of the beholder. It's largely a legal document with political force than a legal document in itself. But there's a broader question about whether we're meeting our commitment to Taiwan in a way that we should be meeting it.
and what a new administration could do coming in. You know, I mentioned earlier some sort of very narrowly defined diplomatic review, and that wouldn't necessarily cover things like the Monterey talks. That could be a bigger thing, you know. But we would cover, you know, arms sales, those sorts of talks, international engagement issues, and the like. But I think another thing that a new administration should focus on is the arms sales process. I think that the initial intention of the Bush administration to change the process through no fault of its own, it had good intention, but didn't quite work out the way it was supposed to work out. And I think ending the annual review process, the annual consultations, took the urgency out of it. It took the action item out of the equation, and so now you can have a request come in for F-16s and it can sit forever because there's no forcing mechanism. So I think that's one very specific thing that we can look at in order to more regularize that commitment.
And with that, so I'm going to open the floor for questions. Please wait for the mic, and before you ask a question, please state your name and your affiliation, and also address your question to a particular person or to the panel. Yeah,
Tina Chung with Voice of America's China branch. Senator Rubio and some congressmen proposed the legislation, the Taiwan Travel Act. I'd like to know if it's a good idea for Congress to take the initiative in loosen or lift the restriction of the travel ban.
I'll start first so that Richard can correct me. I'm inclined to say that the set of travel restrictions we have are not driven by legislation, and I don't think they're easily altered by legislation. They are directed more by the sense, both in Taiwan and in the United States, of what most advances our interests. Okay? And the more substantive our relationship can be with Taiwan, with the least possible visibility, that advances our objectives, it advances Taiwan's objectives, and it reduces the chance of negative reactions from Beijing that are going to make Taiwan's problems more severe.
I see a valuable role for Congress to play in taking the lead on some of these issues for similar reasons that we've discussed. I mean, just because we do have friends and we do have people that care about Taiwan in the government at any given time doesn't mean that they will prevail. And so I think it's perfectly appropriate and sometimes necessary for Congress to take the lead. David mentioned the restriction on diplomats and having to retire from the service. I think that was addressed in the State Department authorization bill back in the early 2000s.
It was the first authorization bill the State Department had in a number of years.
Right.
And it was, I think, a good example of cooperation on that. Because we hit the problem, we realized we had it, we went to some staffers on the Hill and said, we're trying to figure out how to solve this, and they said, you got to do at least this much. And so we had a number of briefings that we had with staffers on the Hill talking about this issue, about how we were thinking about resolving it. And let me just give a shout out for a State Department lawyer who actually sat down at these briefings and said, look, given what the Taiwan Relations Act says, the authorization has to give us at least this much authority. And so just let me note that in addition to legislation, these sorts of briefings and hearings are often a way in which the two branches reach better understandings. And you'd be surprised how much attention an assistant secretary will pay to an issue after a congressman or senator has beat him around the ears for an hour or two.
And I think too, just to give a little bit more context, I think when that work was done cooperatively between State Department and the Congress, there were also several other pieces that were not cooperative. You know, there was a demand signal on the Congress side to do five or six things. I think some of them were left over from the TSEA from a few years before. So this plugged right into it. So this was something State Department, I think, at the time said, okay, you want to do these things, here's something the president won't veto. You can do this.
Do you have any more questions? Oh, okay, that gentleman over there.
Hi, my name is Benjamin Lee. I'm from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. So as far as I know, I think one of the issues in TPR was making sure that Taiwan gets to participate in WTO and under mutual acceptable conditions between China and Taiwan. So I was wondering, given the recent events on International Civil Aviation Organization and Taiwan, China's basic rejection of Taiwan's participation in it, do you see any way that Taiwan can participate in an international organization without formally accepting the 1994 consensus?
The question sort of really has to be put to Beijing. Are they going to take a flexible approach to the 1992 consensus and how President Tsai chooses to address it? And would showing flexibility on Taiwan's international participation, including ICAO, create goodwill among the Taiwan people, which one would think would be a PRC goal?
No, I think that's exactly right. You know, something like the Taiwan Policy Review can address the relationships and the activities between the United States and Taiwan. But once we get out into the multilateral forum, and particularly the UN, we are then engaged in the politics of multilateral activities. And that really is a question of how we can persuade, or how the two sides can persuade each other to meet mutual objectives.
Nadia?
Yeah, you just mentioned that the travel restriction of a high-level official, is it?
It was based on the mutual understanding between the U.S. and Taiwan. I wonder, you know, can you elaborate what kind of understanding on Taiwan did it have benefits that its substantial relationship with the U.S.? And I understand this.
Not sure that we're on the same page on this, but okay. I think the travel restrictions are, obviously, it's people coming into the United States, so then the final analysis, it's a U.S. decision as to who we're going to welcome and who we're not, and what time and under what circumstances. But there are an awful lot of private conversations, or very low-key conversations, that go on between the two sides as we're working that out. And we always have to do it. Asking ourselves, is this particular event going to advance the interests of the United States and Taiwan? And so that's what I meant by having a conversation to make sure that everyone understands what's involved. But at the end of the day, you know, the United States will say if someone wants to travel to the United States, yes or no.
Are there any more questions? Oh, this gentleman in the second. Tony
Kane from American Councils. I'm not quite sure how to ask this question, so it may not come out right, but it seems to me since May 20th, there's been kind of like three parties involved in what's going on, the DPP, the KMT, and the CCP, and that having, in a sense, you could say the CCP and the KMT were both losers in the election from their own points of view, and that therefore they seem to be in some ways reaching out to each other. And I wonder if that's an accurate observation, and if so, how does that affect U.S. policy, and kind of more broadly, what's domestic politics in Taiwan and relations across the strait have to be taken into consideration, since I didn't hear a lot of discussion of that in the panel.
Can I just add a footnote to that, which is this is not the first time this has happened. Okay, if you go back to Chun's re-election 2004. And immediately afterwards, the losing candidate, Lian Zhang, went to the PRC. I will leave it to others to judge whether or not that advanced the interests of Taiwan or even the KMT.
I think it matters in the same way that it mattered in the 2000s with Chen Shui-bian, is that I think domestic politics in Taiwan can actually serve to restrain what we're able to do here. So far, my judgment is Tsai Ing-wen has been as responsible as she can be on these issues, and actually as imaginative and flexible as she can be. It's giving us some room. If that context remains the same into a new presidency, I think we get a lot more room here. If she does something purposely provocative, you know, then it restrains us.
Just to add on to what Dave said, I think it's early days in terms of the KMT figuring out how it's going to try to come back to power, and we already see arguments among different parts of the party on specific things. This may take 4 years, 8 years, but the key question is, you know, how can we get 50.1% of the vote in an election?
Garrett Van der Weis, editor of Taiwan Communique. Thanks for an excellent panel. Going back to the question of Taiwan policy review, basically we have two choices. One is a Big Bang approach, try to do everything in one big swoop, or an incremental approach. And what I hear you saying is, hey, let's do an incremental approach. There's a problem with that, as Walter indicated. How do you measure accountability for that? You do have communication with Congress and so on. It's all fine and nice, but it's not really very transparent. Also, what I hear, particularly young people in Taiwan saying, the Sunflower Generation, hey, we are a democracy. Why are we not treated like a normal country in the world? Why is a dictator from Beijing being welcomed in Washington, D.C., and our elected democratic leader cannot get close to Washington, D.C.? So that's I think, what is going to play a role in your decision, how to move forward.
Let's see if it works. Here we go. I think you're touching on a very central issue here. And it is an issue that has been really at the center of everything we think about on Taiwan for certainly the last 30 years. The challenge is how to do this in ways that advance Taiwan's fundamental interest in prosperity and security. And sometimes the advancing Taiwan's prosperity and security is best done in ways that are not visible. And if that is true, that's going to be frustrating. And I get that. And I certainly sat around and listened and talked to enough of the people who are on the receiving end of that frustration and are feeling that frustration. And I share that frustration. But again, how do we advance the interest first in security, second in prosperity, that Taiwan faces and has managed very, very well in a very difficult situation for a long time?
Let me just add that I think Taiwan leaders understand that as frustrating as this situation is, that Taiwan is better off with a good U.S. relationship than it is with a bad one or none at all. And so maybe they have a responsibility in explaining to people like those in the Sunflower Movement why you have to eat a little bit of bitterness to ensure the country's survival. I'm gonna have to go.
Okay, thank you so much, Richard. And multiple.
Yeah, I just finish with one comment on the issue.
One of the reasons why I think it's so important is that Taiwan gets in a situation where it's basically held hostage by the administration, whatever the party of the administration happens to be in office. And again, no matter how many friends we have, the decisions are finally made at levels beyond most of our friends, right? And so the U.S. government holds the Taiwan government hostage because the rest of us don't know all the things that are going on. So they can't get out, say in this instance, TechRo or other supporters of Taiwan can't get out and lobby Congress because the administration's telling them, don't do that. If you do that, the thing that we were planning last week that we haven't told everyone about, it's off, okay? And so that's where accountability, I think, is important to set the context for a relationship that's more sort of productive across the board.
I may have a little bit more respect for the power of Congress than you're suggesting. And just two thoughts. TechRo has made its money for generations by effectively lobbying Congress, okay? And they have done so exceptionally well with some exceptionally talented people. If we ever went to TechRo and said, don't lobby the Congress, they were sort of like, well, that's fine, but I'm late for lunch. because they're having a lunch up on the Hill. Second, when all is said and done, the Congress has one final stick, and it's called the power of the appropriation. And they have on occasion used that stick, and I would simply note the case of the Lee Teng-hui visit to Cornell. And we can have a discussion as to whether that was a good thing or a bad thing, but in the end of the day, the Congress said, you will do this.
Well, on that note, please join me in thanking the panelists for the discussion today. And also, if you haven't been subscribed to our newsletter, please do at www.globaltaiwan.org. We have our next event in 2 weeks on U.S.-Taiwan maritime cooperation, and the invitation will be going out today, so please stay tuned. Thank you.